This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What are unenumerated rights? Put simply, they are commonly held rights not explicitly written into the text of the Constitution. However, they may be so commonly accepted that explicit enumeration in the Constitution isn't required. But of course, how do you define what's commonly accepted in a diverse democracy? Well, the justices of the United States Supreme Court have often turned to a particular measure. And it's that belief that's central to Justice Samuel Alito's leaked draft opinion that signals the court's willingness to overturn Roe v. Wade. Alito writes, quote, "The inescapable conclusion is that a right to abortion is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions," end quote. Whose history, though? Whose traditions? What period of time must pass before either history or tradition is established? I mean, there have always been interracial couples in the United States, but their unenumerated right to marry wasn't recognized until 1967. There have always been same-sex couples, but their right to marry isn't even a decade old. So if Justice Alito can point to abortion, which, by the way, there have always been abortions in the United States both before and after the nation's founding, if he can point to abortion as a right not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions, then what of the other unenumerated rights that allow people to live freely? Well, joining us now is Kenji Yoshino. He's the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University School of Law, also the director for the Center of Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging, and author of a forthcoming book called Say the Right Thing: How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Professor Yoshino, welcome to On Point.
It's great to be with you, Meghna.
Also with us today is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, with us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Kenji.
So I wonder, Professor Yoshino, if we can just start with some basic definitions so that we're all operating off the same page here. What are some of the unenumerated rights that are currently recognized in the United States, some that we might recognize and maybe some that are less familiar?
Great. Yes. So the ones that you mentioned are definitely included, like the right to have an abortion, the right to contraception, the right to same-sex marriage, the right to privacy and engaging in sexual intimacy in one's own home. But the ones that I think come less easily to mind are things like the right to travel, which is nowhere in the Constitution, the right to vote, or even the right to heterosexual marriage, because the right to marry is nowhere enumerated in the Constitution.
So the right to travel and something as fundamental as voting, is you would say that's not explicitly in the Constitution? Or is it not explicitly in the Constitution for everyone?
It actually is the flip side of that with regard to voting, right? Because there are prohibitions against restricting the franchise on the basis of race in the 15th Amendment, or on the basis of gender in the 19th Amendment, or on the basis of, you know, wealth or age in the 24th or 26th Amendments. But the right to vote is not itself explicitly protected as a right. So ironically, right, the 15th, 19th, 24th, and 26th Amendments say you can't give the right to vote with an unequal hand as government, but the right to vote itself is nowhere enumerated. For something as fundamental that the Supreme Court has called the right preservative of all the rights is itself not enumerated in the Constitution.
Wow. Okay. And what about travel? That is not one I would have thought of ever.
Yeah, it's a fun one, right? Because you think like, oh, of course I have the right to drive across the border from, you know, New York to New Jersey, because New York is where I live. But, you know, that's nowhere guaranteed in the Constitution. It has been deemed to be an unenumerated fundamental right that is absolutely necessary, right, for our, you know, capacity to live as a, you know, federal system. So, of course, right, New Jersey can't say, no, New Yorkers can't come in, or even, of course, New Yorkers can't come here, right, without paying a toll. Or, of course, we can't say that New Yorkers can't, you know, travel across state lines because we're worried that, you know, we'll become a magnet for, you know, indigent individuals. This is where it often comes up. The right to travel often comes up, is that states that have more progressive policies with regard to indigency and more generous, you know, allowances for individuals who are homeless often erect barriers about how long you have to reside in the state before you can avail yourself of those benefits.
Okay.
The Supreme Court has repeatedly struck those down, saying that those violate the right to travel.
So when we say unenumerated rights then, Professor Yoshino, what you're saying is we're talking about all manner of things that we wake up in the morning presuming are just there as fundamentals if you're alive in the United States today.
Exactly. It's the air we breathe. And if I can even go further than that, it's really the foundation on which, you know, the Constitution has been built, right? Because, you know, as many of your listeners know, at the very founding of the Constitution, there was this document that was, you know, ratified in 1789 that deservedly, you know, earns all of our praise. But the condition that certain individuals who ratified the Constitution, called the Anti-Federalists, who were worried about overweening federal governmental power, sort of reserved, right, was to say, we will only vote for this if you enact a Bill of Rights. And so they enacted a Bill of Rights 2 years later and ratified it in 1791. But one of those Bill of Rights, you know, is the Ninth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment, Magna says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And so what I love about that is that there's a textual reference in the Constitution to the idea that there are textually unenumerated rights. So there's a little bit of a paradox right there, because there's text saying that there are textually unenumerated rights. And the reason I find that to be so important is that I think oftentimes people's reaction to unenumerated rights is, well, these are all just made up. But in fact, you know, they derive from the very founding, right, which is the idea that we can't enumerate all the rights, you know, in advance because we're not so prescient that we can foresee every single contingency that's going to arise. And so we acknowledge that this list of rights in the Bill of Rights is exemplary rather than exhaustive.
Wow. Okay, so I'm seeing here that the Ninth Amendment was, we can thank James Madison for that, perhaps. And that, again, just to reiterate what you're saying, Professor Yoshino, that it was put in the Bill of Rights specifically so that the Constitution could reflect that there are rights that ought to be granted to the people of the United States that were not specifically written already into the Constitution as the addressed in 1789. That is absolutely fascinating. And quite frankly, I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't even remember the ninth out of the first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States. But Jack Beatty, jump in here. Your first thoughts about, you know, Professor Yoshino calls these unenumerated rights akin to the air we breathe in the United States.
Yes, and that we take for granted. But, you know, until a few years ago, we took for granted that there was a fundamental right to abortion. It was a settled law, it seemed. And we had a succession of conservative justices before the Congress saying, oh, it's settled law. It's a super precedent. It seemed the air we breathed. But suddenly, not so. And I think what the professor is suggesting is we may be at a point where things that look to be the air we breathe are going to be, the air is going to be taken away. Mm-hmm. that they rest on dubious foundations that justices like Alito, with the bit between his teeth, the bit really of setting, he says democracy, returning these questions to the people. Others would say reaction. With the bit between his teeth, can they go on and take down other rights that we think are the air we breathe?
Hmm. So here's a question that follows from that, Professor Yoshino. And that is, again, I'm looking back at the Ninth Amendment, because Jack's raising basically what's the fundamental question of this hour, which is, okay, the Ninth Amendment might say that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. But how do you define what retained by the people means, right? I think that's kind of one the question that Justice Alito says abortion does not answer. So for, you know, give us an example, privacy in the home, travel, whichever one you want, Professor Yoshino, what is the process by which those that particular unenumerated right was proven to have been retained by the people in the eyes of the court?
Great. It's a wonderful question, Meghna. Thank you. So basically, there are two tests for how to decide what is an unenumerated right. And I want to sort of begin by saying everyone acknowledges, right, that there are unenumerated rights because of the Ninth Amendment, right? So we know that they exist. But as you say, the kind of million-dollar question is, okay, even if I grant that there are these unwritten rights, how do I know which rights are protected? Because ultimately, it's going to be the Supreme Court that tells us what's in and what's out. So the more kind of conservative test that conservatives have loved, you know, and that Justice Alito is trying to resurrect is a 1997 test that comes from the case Washington versus Glucksberg. And in Glucksberg, the court said, when you're trying to ascertain whether something is an unenumerated right, history is going to be your guide. And so the formal test is to question whether or not the right that people are proposing is, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions, and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. So if you think about that, that is going to be a very backwards-looking test. And the alternative test, which was proposed by Justice Harlan initially in his dissent in a case called Poe versus Ullman, which actually predated Washington versus Glucksberg, but was a dissent, but was later embraced by the Casey majority in 1992, is this test that says there can't really be any formula. We, of course, look to history as our guide, right? But we look not only at the traditions that we have as a country, but also the traditions from which we broke. And Harlan says that tradition is a living thing.
Oh, fascinating.
So it's really that debate between those two tests that's going to be the clincher here.
Okay. And by the way, Casey being the other major abortion case in recent memory. So Professor Kenji Yoshino and Jack Beattie, stand by here. We're talking about what unenumerated rights are in the United States and their fragility as this nation attempts to move forward. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the fragility of unenumerated rights in the United States. Now, those rights are everything from the more famous ones that you might know, currently the right to access abortion, the right to same-sex marriage, the right to interracial marriage, and it goes even further to rights that you may never even think of, such as the right to travel across state lines, even the affirmative right to vote, unenumerated in the Constitution of the United States. And I'm joined today by Kenji Yoshino. He's a professor of constitutional law at New York University and author of Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Jack Beattie also joins us, and he's our On Point news analyst. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the key cases that have helped us understand what unenumerated rights are in the United States. But Jack, you're one of the possibly the most brilliant historian I know. And when Professor Yoshino in the previous segment said that the justices have long looked at this particular belief that to define an unenumerated right, that one of the guides will be history. History is going to be your guide. I'm just wondering what you think about that, Jack. Is history a good guide when it comes to thinking of the complexities of law in a modern democracy?
Well, you know, I can frame that in terms of two quotations from novels. One, the first lines of L.P. Hartley's novel, The Go-Between. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. In the past, they had slavery. In the past, gay people couldn't marry. In the past, there was no right to abortion. In the past, there was no right to privacy. They did things differently in the past. So if you look to the past, you make the present hostage to it and to its injustices, a point that Justice Kennedy makes very eloquently when he says, the nature of injustice is that we may not always see it in our own time. And that applies to people in the past. They didn't see things as unjust that we do today. The second quotation is from William Faulkner, and this is actually used by Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, in his dissent in Obergefell, the gay rights case, the gay rights marriage case. He quotes Faulkner saying, the past is not dead. It is not even past. So there's the two view. The past is a foreign country, not relevant to us. And no, the past is not even past. And it seems to me that the Alito draft opinion on taking down Roe is out of that. The past is not past. It is not even past.
Professor Yoshino, what do you think about that?
I love those two quotes, and what a great way to bookend those two ideas. I might sort of offer a different interpretation of that, though, because I think that what Alito is saying is the past is another country, and we like that country better, and so we're going to fashion the country in 2022 along the lines of that older country.
Well, you know, what I want to do now is, again, there are some critical cases here that help us understand how these perceptions of the importance of history, however you define it, and tradition have made their way into actually, you know, how the justices are interpreting the law. So, Professor Yoshino, you had mentioned Washington v. Glucksberg a couple of minutes ago. So just to remind folks, that is the 1997 case in which the question was, did the state of Washington's ban on physician-assisted suicide violate the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause because it denied competent terminally ill adults the liberty to choose their own death over life? So that was the question before the court in 1997. And the court focused on two aspects, historic roots and again, that issue of liberty interest.
We have repeatedly emphasized that fundamental rights are those that are deeply rooted in our nation's traditions. We have also insisted that the fundamental right at issue in a particular due process case be framed rather precisely. Thus, the issue before us today is not the broad question of whether there's a constitutional right to determine the time and manner of one's death, but instead whether the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause includes a right to commit physician-assisted suicide.
That's Chief Justice William Rehnquist there. And in his opinion, he noted that Glucksberg's argument failed on both aspects.
For centuries, our Anglo-American legal tradition has punished or otherwise disapproved of both suicide and assisting suicide. It's true that attitudes towards suicide itself have changed over the years, but it is still regarded as a grave public wrong.
Put more specifically or straightforwardly, the court held that the right to assisted suicide is not a fundamental liberty interest protected by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. The court also ruled that Washington's ban was related to the state's interest in protecting medical ethics. So essentially, the justices referred the matter to the states. But there is actually quite a bit more nuance here. And so to understand that, we reach out to Catherine Tucker. She's currently special counsel at Emerge Law Group in Portland, Oregon. But in 1997, she argued on behalf of Dr. Harold Glucksberg, one of the four Washington state physicians who challenged the state's ban on physician-assisted suicide. Today, Catherine Tucker says, when looking at history to judge a constitutional right, the question is the Constitution a living document that accommodates the evolution in society?
The way we provide care and what medicine can do for dying patients is vastly different now, at this point in time, and when the court considered Glucksberg and Quill, than it was when the Constitution was written.
By the way, Quill v. New York, which she refers to there, was a parallel physician-assisted suicide case on the East Coast. Now, Tucker says while the Supreme Court's opinion acknowledged the importance of protecting fundamental rights, due to their historic roots and in tradition, the 97 Glucksberg case also gave space to the concept that the framers of the Constitution could not have predicted scientific advancements made since 1789.
Glucksberg was very careful to preserve the possibility that in future, the court would find a protected liberty interest. At the time, some of the criticisms of Roe were that the court got too far out front of where society was. And I think there was a wariness to do that on this issue.
And the issue, again, she's talking about there is physician-assisted suicide in the Glucksberg case. So given that, what does Tucker make of Justice Alito's reliance on the Glucksberg case in his reasoning to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Well, I would say that it's a cramped reading of Glucksberg. To go to a rigid, fundamentalist reading of the Constitution, it just freezes protections to those that could have been known by society at the time the Constitution was written. And that is really distressing. History evolves, medicine evolves, and we need to be able to have an evolving constitution that's based on principles, not fundamentalist text.
That's Catherine Tucker. She argued before the court in 1997's Washington v. Glucksberg case. She's now with the Emerge Law Group in Portland, Oregon. Professor Yoshino, Catherine Tucker said a lot there, but first of all, respond to what she said about the court's unwillingness to get too far out in front of where society was or is, and how that played a role in Glucksberg because of, you know, the question there being physician-assisted suicide. Because that seems to be a constant theme in the court, no matter its makeup, right?
Yes, absolutely. We often like to think, right, before we go to law school, that, you know, the justices, you know, let the skies fall, right, and make a judgment without regard to any kind of popular opinion. But I think to, you know, study constitutional law at all is to understand that it's always a conversation in between where society is at the time and what, you know, principles are going to be discerned in the Constitution. So my favorite example of this, Meghna, is, you know, a 2000 case called the United States versus Dickerson, where the Supreme Court justices upheld the Miranda warning. And Chief Justice Rehnquist, whom you quoted earlier, actually upheld the Miranda warning. And he was a staunch conservative and no friend of the Miranda warning, which was the, you know, rights that are read to you that we all know from every police procedural. But he said, these rights have become so much of a part of our national culture that there's no way that we could get rid of them. And I laugh at that, right? Because that's not like, you know, Congress is a co-equal constitutional interpreter. That's Hollywood as a co-equal constitutional interpreter. That's saying, like, there have been too many episodes of Law and Order for us to actually, you know, rescind this right now, because more people can recite the Miranda warning of the right to remain silent, right, than can recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Huh. So this question of how history is sort of demonstrated, or tradition is demonstrated in the United States to the satisfaction of the justices, whether it's tradition that we want to adhere to or break from, as you noted earlier, Yoshino, Professor Yoshino, it's really interesting to me because, Jack, I want to turn this one to you, because I was thinking this morning about the fact that over the past 10 years or so, I have had the chance to interview Mary Bonato several times. Now, for folks who don't know her name, she's actually quite a huge figure in civil rights in the United States, because she's the Civil Rights Project Director at GLAAD, one of the leading LGBTQ legal organizations in the country. And in 2004, she argued the Goodridge case in Massachusetts that legalized same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. And then in 2015, she was on the legal team that successfully argued Obergefell, that did the same at the federal level, recognized same-sex marriage as a right in the United States. Now, the reason why I bring her up is because in my many interviews I've had with her over the past few years, she repeatedly told me that she thought that the way to ultimately achieve the federal legal right to same-sex marriage was, in a sense, to work your way up. She thought a lot about how to create the legal history that would allow the justices to affirmatively decide for the right of gay couples to marry. So she said, first, let's start off with parents with children. Like, we want to argue that we shouldn't break up families just because a parent is gay. So argue that at the state level. Then she said, protecting jobs. Argue that at the state level. And then work your way up and to marriage. And the reason why I mentioned that, Jack, is I wonder what you think about that as, you know, essentially the framework that the justices eventually need to say yes to these unenumerated rights.
Well, they can point to things, but there's nothing there to put a brake on arbitrariness, right? What do you point to? And that always comes back to, it seems to me, the judge's view of life. Justice Blackmun in Roe v. Wade speaks of justice's experience of the raw edges of life. That makes a difference in jurisprudence. And there's another way of looking at it, and that is, don't look back, look now. And that's the point that Justice Kennedy made in his majority opinion. He said, changed understanding of marriage, a characteristic of a nation, quote, where new dimensions of freedom become apparent to new generations. New conceptions of freedom, changing what we think freedom should be. Justice Frankfurter put it this way. He said, great concepts like liberty were purposely left to gather meaning from experience. And this says, no, you can't look back. You really need to look at the present and what do we think freedom entails? What do we think liberty entails? And build law from that. It is looking at the present. It's not, you know, full of precedent and the rest, but it's an expansive, and it seems to me, in Justice Kennedy's opinion, an eloquent view of how the law should change as the times change.
Yeah. I'd also say that the most recognizable aspect of the history and tradition of the United States is that of personal liberty. The question is, who are the justices willing to apply that to? But Professor Yoshino, you know, I hear what Jack is saying, and that makes me think of a fundamental challenge. I'm not going to call it a problem, but a challenge in the system of governance in the United States. And here I'll sort of paraphrase Professor Randy Kennedy at Harvard Law School, because he's told us that he believes the law is the purest distillation of our politics, right? He was once even a clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall, and even he applied that to Marshall, too, because ultimately all these decisions and interpretations are passing through the minds and lives, as Jack pointed out, of human beings on the bench. So isn't any particular answer to what qualifies as history and tradition in the United States really tied to the politics of the moment as demonstrated by the court?
Absolutely. And I want to go back to the Glucksberg test, because I agree that thinking of Dobbs as adopting a very cramped reading of Glucksberg is a really good characterization. Because what you're saying, Meghna, is this is actually Justice Alito's version of history, and obviously mm-hmm. the people who signed on to that opinion. And his version of history is very narrow indeed. So what he's saying is the test here is whether or not the unenumerated right is deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions. And then he says abortion is clearly not that. And so QED, you know, abortion is not, you know, a fundamental right. But, you know, as Jack was saying earlier, you know, the right to abortion has been around since 1973. As you said earlier, abortions themselves, you know, have been conducted since time immemorial, right? And so he's selecting a very particular version of when history begins and what constitutes that history in order to come to the result that he comes to in that decision. I will just point out that the recent opinions of the Supreme Court with regard to unenumerated rights would be impossible under that cramped understanding of how unenumerated rights are chosen. So Alito, in fairness to him, says, you know, in his opinion, this has no implications for any other rights. So we're not talking about contraception. We're not talking about same-sex marriage. We're not talking about interracial marriage. You know, all those rights are, you know, not affected by this opinion. But, you know, in fairness to the opponents of Alito, I would say, you know, that's not how adjudication works. You know, so Larry Tribe up at Harvard has also said, like, well, wait a minute. You can't sort of articulate a test and then say this doesn't implicate any other rights, because the right to contraception, under his notion of history, is not deeply rooted in the common law. You know, the right to same-sex marriage is not deeply rooted in the common law. The right to interracial marriage is not rooted in the common law. And so it's hard to see, if we adopt that, again, very stingy vision of how we discern unenumerated rights in the Constitution, that those other rights would not also be imperiled.
Or stingy, or as Jack put it, the arbitrariness of it. So when we come back from the break, I want to talk with both of you more about, you know, is there a way for the nation to move forward and have the protection of unenumerated rights not feel so arbitrary, or be as arbitrary as it is now? So that's what we're going to talk about in the last part of the show. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the fragility of unenumerated rights in the United States. I'm joined by Kenji Yoshino. He's a professor of constitutional law at New York University and author of the book Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Jack Beattie joins us as well. He's On Point's news analyst, and getting some comments here over social media. Bob Ziegler says, if we only had rights that are, quote, deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions, we would be in sad shape indeed. And Stephen Mark says, based on the Alito draft opinion, why not also overturn Brown v. Board? America has a deeply rooted tradition of being unequal, having been a slaveholding or segregated country much longer than an integrated one. Also, why not Stanley v. Georgia? The government clearly could limit media in your home for most of our existence. So people asking questions about, again, rights that we just presume are part of the air we breathe, as Professor Yoshino put it. Now, there's another case really important to our overall understanding of how the justices see unenumerated rights that I want to spend a minute or two talking about. And that is Griswold v. Connecticut from 1965. And in that case, we actually see, I think I can probably call it a precedent on how the court decided to discern an unenumerated right.
Is there any constitutional provision that says that?
We're relying on the due process clause.
Is there any other constitutional provision on which you could possibly rely for it?
We rely on the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments insofar as they embody a concept of the right of privacy.
So that's from Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965, and you heard Justice Hugo Black and Attorney Thomas Emerson there talking about what are the various provisions of the Constitution from which emerges the concept of a right of privacy. Professor Yoshino, tell us more about Griswold.
Yeah, Griswold is a really fun case to teach because, as you say, it's a 1965 case that deals with the right to contraception, which it ultimately, you know, vindicates and says is a constitutional right. But the right to contraception is nowhere enumerated in the Constitution. So as you heard in that exchange, the million-dollar question is, from whence does this right derive? And one answer which the court does embrace is this notion of penumbra. So the idea is that the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments are textually enumerated rights, And all of them sort of embody some notion of the right to privacy. So the Third Amendment is the amendment that says the government can't put troops in my house during peacetime and quarter them there. The Fourth Amendment, as we know, is the amendment that protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures in our home by government. And the Fifth Amendment contains a right against self-incrimination. And so that's a kind of decisional notion of the government can't, you know, force me to testify and kind of invade my mind, right? So whether it's a kind of space-place conception of privacy or whether it's a decisional conception of privacy, the notion is the right to privacy is protected. And the court ultimately says, adding also in the First Amendment right to assembly and also the Ninth Amendment, you know, calling back to our favorite amendment there, it says, you know, penumbras around the First, Third, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment, you know, create a right to privacy. So what they're getting at, a penumbra is just a shadow, right, is that these textual provisions cast these shadows, and those shadows, which all contain this notion of privacy, overlap with each other such that they coalesce into a right in its own right, right? So that this right to privacy under which the right to contraception is protected is derived from the shadows of actual textual provisions. So text is being used as a counterweight to the lack of history, right, on point here.
Well, so Jack, this is exactly the same argument that was used in Roe, right? The attorneys who argued on behalf of Roe in the 1970s pulled from a variety of different amendments to make the same argument about this penumbra. But you know, of course, a shadow is no longer cast when the light of politics changes around it.
Yes, and the wording is sort of well, I won't say ludicrously, but here's Justice Douglas's opinion: the foregoing case, the Griswold case, suggest that specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights have penumbras formed by emanations from their guarantees that give them life and substance. The penumbras and the emanations. You can see a conservative, hard-headed justice saying, what in the name of heaven does this mean? And you know, Justice Roberts, in his dissent in Obergefell, you know, says this kind of talk about, you know, you find rights where you want it is reminiscent of Lochner, the famous case where the justices found that there was a right to contract in the Constitution such that it had never been mentioned, but it was projected there. That was their penumbra. And I guess I'm just worried about this, Professor, that even something as basic as privacy, the penumbra and the emanation and so on, may be on shaky constitutional ground.
Yep, I totally agree. You know, I think that for a lot of people are sort of protesting against this because they think that the penumbra analysis, you know, protects us because it's rooted in text, you know, rather than in history. But I think that, you know, if we sincerely apply this Alito test of is the right to contraception deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions, the answer is no, the right to contraception is not so secure, right? And so I think it's also on the chopping block. If I can take a step back for a minute, you know, I think that if we don't have history, then the question is, what do we have?
Right.
I mentioned that there were two tests, right? One is the Glucksberg test, and the other one is this Justice Harlan test from the Poe versus Ullman dissent that Justice Kennedy actually picks up on. So the language that Jack was quoting from the Justice Kennedy opinions is totally on point and also very indebted to Justice Harlan and Poe versus Ullman, where he says tradition is a living thing, tradition is relevant, but we have to look not only at the traditions that we adhere to, but also to the traditions from which we broke, because traditions can blind us to things.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so
just,
for me,
please, Professor Yoshino, go ahead.
Oh, I'm just going to, just to land the plane here, right? I mean, I want to just sort of say that it's actually a very fair question to direct towards progressive constitutionalists like myself to say, okay, you know, Yoshino, if it's not history, right, like Alito says, and you're not particularly persuaded by the penumbra theory, sort of neutral on that. I'm not going to inveigh against it, but I don't think that's really the answer. Then, you know, you got to have something to beat something. Because if you just say, oh, you know, it's just not tradition, then that's, again, the kind of free-for-all that we're all worried about. So the principle that I want to adhere to is equality. And some of your callers, right, during the break, you know, alluded to this and mentioning cases like Brown versus Board of Education. Because one of the really, really interesting things that we haven't talked about yet that sort of ties together all of the cases that are now imperiled because they're not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions is the equality concern. So I want to say that if you go back a century, even to the 1920s, the case was striking down, you know, regulations under unenumerated rights of parents to educate their children and to control those educations, statutes that said you can't teach your kid German or you can't send your kid to parochial school. And what were those statutes really about? Those statutes are really about, we don't want you teaching German after World War I because we don't like Germans, and we don't want you to send your kids to parochial school because of an anti-Catholic sentiment. Fast forward to Griswold. Griswold and Roe are clearly about the equality rights of women. You know, fast forward to Loving versus Virginia, 2 years after Griswold in 1967. That's about interracial marriage and the rights of racial minorities. Fast forward to 2003 or 2015. Those are gay rights cases in Lawrence and Obergefell, respectively. So many of these unenumerated rights, including but not limited, obviously, to the relationship abortion has to women, have to do with equality and have to do, going back to the founding again, with status-based exclusions from we the people, right? This notion of the people who created this foundational document were not fully representative. So what kinds of rights are going to draw our special solicitude? Those are going to be rights that have a disproportionate impact, right, and negatively affecting the ability of individuals who are not represented in that original compact and living their lives on an equal footing with everybody else. So whether that's a right to educate your children, you know, relating to national origin minorities or religious minorities, whether that's contraception and abortion relating to women, whether that's the right to interracial marriage or an earlier case about conveying property with regard to the rights of racial minorities, or whether that's, you know, Lawrence and Obergefell, the right to engage in sexual intimacy in the privacy of your home and the right to same-sex marriage and the LGBT community. All of these rights have some deep implication for a group that was not at the table, you know, at the founding.
Interesting that you should say that, Professor Yoshino, because that brings to mind a conversation that we had on this program back in September 2020. Then we were joined by legendary civil rights activist Bob Moses, and folks might remember he's a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during the Civil Rights Movement. In 1964, Moses helped organize the voter recruitment drives in Mississippi's Freedom Summer. And when we spoke to him in 2020, Bob Moses talked at length about the point you just made, Professor Yoshino, about how the history of individual and civil rights in this country is a history of expanding the circle of Americans, and that the perimeter of that circle has had to be pushed outward, pushed, ever since the Constitution's creation in 1787.
The preamble says, well, these are the constitutional people who ordain and establish this Constitution. And as we know, they were white men who owned property. Article 4, Section 2, Paragraph 3 says something about not only what kind of property they may own, but who. And so we have a class of constitutional people who are Africans, and they are the property of the former, of the preamble people.
But the Freedom Summer Project of 1964, Moses and other civil rights activists with the civil rights movement attempt to redefine what the nation saw as constitutional people.
So Freedom Summer was an attempt in the broadest sense to look at the preamble and to say to African-American sharecroppers in Mississippi, you are constitutional people and you are part of the United States as constitutional people, right? It's an attempt to broaden the reach of the preamble, an attempt to break down the caste system.
So there it is, broaden the reach of the preamble. In other words, broaden the reach of what it means to be we the people. And to accomplish that goal in the 1960s, Moses told us that white volunteers of the Freedom Summer tried to expose the difficulty of the black experience in Mississippi to the rest of the country by living it.
Just the act of living, right? We weren't asking them to do something courageous, right? What was courageous was just going there and living with African-American people and experiencing their lives, right? It was a shock to some of them that they couldn't walk downtown. Yeah, they're in a, what they think is America, but it was dangerous, you know, just to walk downtown.
That's legendary civil rights activist Bob Moses, who was on this show in September 2020. He died less than a year later, August 2021. Now, Jack and Professor Yoshino, listening back to Bob Moses and to what both of you have been saying this hour, to me, one of the fundamental problems here is the Constitution itself. I mean, because the founders created a system of checks and balances to prevent, as far as I see it, the, you know, the emergence of a monarchical system of government or prevent anarchy. And that works. It has historically worked in this country to create a stable system of government. But it's also created, in my view, a system that by design, I think, is resistant to civil rights progress because, you know, to prevent anarchy, the interest of the government is to preserve the status quo. And as we've talked about this hour, the status quo can be broken. Sometimes it takes a civil war. A lot of the times it takes legal action. And legal action because the people can't find redress through constitution or congressional lawmaking. So, Jack, let me just turn to you first. I mean, somehow I feel like the ultimate solution here is to preserve the best of what the Constitution of the United States has done for this country, but also modernize it so it can keep meeting the needs of the nation today.
Well, look at the Senate. I mean, that would be the most flagrant example. The other day, Nina Totenberg on our air said that the senators who were in favor of gun restrictions represented 44 million more people than the Republican senators against it. And yet we are hostage, the 44 million extra are hostage to this minoritarian rule established in the Senate. And that right there seems to me a part of the constitutional design that is clearly not working and indeed enshrining and embedding the most noxious elements of the status quo, namely we have more guns than people.
Mm. Well, Professor Yoshino, we've got about a minute left and you get the last word here because I hear you clearly on your call to using equality as the test, right? But other than the 14th Amendment and equal protection, do we need a sort of a more affirmative language of equality in the Constitution such that that test can be non-arbitrarily applied in the future?
Well, I actually think that the Equal Protection Clause, the majestic clause in the 14th Amendment that says no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, is fully capable of doing this work. It's just that very, again, cramped readings of the Equal Protection Clause have prevented it from doing that. And I think part of that, it's kind of like squeezing a balloon, that when you squeeze a balloon, the air doesn't go out, it just gets moved over. One of the reasons why liberty and unenumerated rights is being asked to do so much equality work is because the court has squeezed the equal protection provision so much that the liberty clauses have had to pick up that slack.
Well, I'm going to give you 10 more seconds here, Professor. Are you concerned about the future of some of the unenumerated rights we talked about today?
I'm extremely concerned about them. You know, I think time will tell, and only time will tell, but we have a test being articulated by the draft Dobbs opinion that, if applied rigorously, would mean the demise of many of the unenumerated rights that we have come to take for granted. So I'm extremely concerned. I'm about to head in to teach my new constitutional law class, and I feel like I'm teaching the generation that's going to have to fix this because I'm not relying on my generation to be able to do it.
Well, Kenji Yoshino, a professor of law at New York University, thank you so much. And Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.